I'm looking forward to our discussion tonight. Leslie, what do you want to share with us about this topic?
Thank you, Peter, and hello, everybody. I'm so happy to be here. And I want to begin by reminding everybody that this is a second, actually, it's the third, but I'm calling it the second of a three-part exploration that I'm doing of the practice of po post-meditation investigation. And as you Some of you may remember back in August, I gave a talk on my experience that I had at the 10-day Goenka retreat in September. And in that talk, I sort of framed the talk around the fact that all of the hindrances were rising up in full force in those 10 days that I was at that retreat. So I had a wonderful opportunity to really, examine the hindrances and try to come to a deeper understanding of how they were working in my own mind and in my own life. That was in August. And then last in September, I gave a follow-up talk on the hindrances and the various protocols that are out there in the world for addressing the hindrances, for examining them, for gaining insight through them. And if you were not there for that talk back in September, I'll give you a list of some of the people that we talked about, the protocols that we talked about. Joseph Goldstein and Bonte G. and Gil Fronsdale. And I didn't have time to talk about Shyla Catherine's book and her protocol that she gives for dealing with the hindrances. So I put that into a, I just put pushed that off to another session. So you might, if you've been paying attention in that way, you might kind of see that I'm somebody who has a great admiration for protocols. And, I don't quite know what that comes from, where that comes from. It's not like my parents laid out protocols of behavior when I was a kid, but I think it might have something to do with my career. My teaching career started as a seventh grade teacher in Bunston, Missouri. And I was a brand new teacher, and I was struggling mightily in that first year of teaching to find the right protocols, the right, because I knew I had to take these wild and crazy seventh graders through very specific steps in order to get them to the kinds of knowledge that and skill that I wanted them to have. So it might go back to that, but it has carried throughout my life, my interest in protocols, and many of the books that I've talked about on this in this sangha have been essentially protocols of how to live or what to do to address the obstacles or the hindrances that you're facing. And you all know this. It doesn't take going to an actual brick and mortar bookstore to figure this out because we're just bombarded with so many books these days that give us protocols on a whole variety of things from exercise to training your mind to eating, ways of eating. The marketplace is really just filled with quick fix, well, maybe not so quick. They often sound quick fix, like quick fix protocols for really just about anything that ails you. I'm just going to list some that I just quickly put down, just thinking off the top of my head. Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg was a book that I used with those seventh graders, which gives a very specific and concrete protocol for how to teach students to write expressively. There's a real popular book out now by a podcaster whose name is Mel Robbins. It's called Let Them. The books that I'm mentioning are all books that have similar protocols to what we find in the Dharma. And so I just wanted to give you a sort of sense of what's out there in the world in terms of steps or stages. If you're the kind of person that likes to be given steps and stages in trying to get to a certain skill set or get to a level of understanding, then these are the kinds of books you go for. They're certainly the kind of books I go for. I've talked on this at this Sangha on Meditations for Mortals. Four Weeks is the name of it, and it's called Meditations for Mortals. That's by Oliver Berkman. The Fine Art of Not Giving a Fuck, Mark Mason. Excuse my language, but that's the title. The Fine Art of Not Giving a Fuck is right out of Buddha. Never makes one mention to the Buddhist texts at all. Then we have the Tao Te Ching, another protocol that I have followed for years and love. There's Marcus Aurelius's Meditations, which is really one of our first introductions to Stoicism. The Ten Commandments of the Bible, maybe one of the most well-known protocol. The 12 Steps of AA. The book on the Compassion Project that I discussed several months ago by Karen Armstrong gives a very specific 12-step protocol in how to become more kind and compassionate. And then, of course, there's the many books on the Paramis, but the one that I've talked about here is the one by Joseph Goldstein and his student, whose name I can't remember now. It's called Integrity. Anyway, you get the idea. I love protocols, and I love books that sort of outline steps or procedures that you can go through. So, as we looked at these protocols in my last session in September, we went through, as I said, the protocols that Joseph Goldstein advises for dealing with the hindrances, Bhante G and Gil Fronsdale. And all of those protocols are what we call post-meditation investigation. Now, that's not a term that the Buddha would have used, but remember, investigation is the second of the seven, right after mindfulness, it's the second of the seven factors of awakening. So this process of investigation is a really important component of our practice. It takes us to a place beyond what we're actually doing in the actual sitting. So each one of these post-meditation investigations offer a framework, kind of, for us to examine the nature and the effects of our own mind, investigating what is emerging in consciousness and whether it is wholesome or unwholesome is what we do when we do post-meditation investigation. We investigate mental experiences that rise up during meditation, and we apply the three characters of existence to them: suffering, impermanence, and the selfing story or non-self. The Lojong teachings, which we did in one of the study groups that Peter did a couple of years ago, we studied the Lojong teachings, and they tell us to combine mindfulness and investigation as a routine part of life. We all have a strong tendency to distance ourselves from our experience because it hurts. So a lot of times there's disturbing things that come up in meditation or repetitive conversations or dialogues that are going on that are challenging to deal with. But that distancing from that experience, even though it's painful sometimes and uncomfortable, is not healthy for a practitioner, the kind of practitioners that we are. The Dharma provides encouragement to move closer to experience. In investigation, we turn our attention to the mind and what it's actually doing. Most protocols say that when you look right into a thought or an emotion, nothing is seen. And we're told to relax completely, to let everything go, and rest in a state of emptiness. That is the prescription to follow. And Sister Dang Nguyen says, no matter how many thoughts or emotions are there, when they aren't held, they go freely on their own and become the accumulation of pristine wisdom. Oh my gosh, I have to read that again. Listen to this. No matter how many thoughts or emotions are in our head, she says, are there, when they aren't held, that is, when we don't grasp them, when we don't cling to them, they go freely on their own, and they become then the accumulation of pristine wisdom. Yep, 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 that's what I want. That's exactly what I want. And that's what we're all doing together in this Sangha, and in the reading groups, and in the retreats that we're attending, and in the conferences we're having with our teachers. So I think you can see that I'm trying to build a case to support the high benefits of undertaking a serious investigation practice as part of your whole Dharma life, done in the presence of a good teacher or a Sangha or a trusted spiritual friend. I do not recommend doing, well, I guess we do it all the time. I'm constantly investigating my mental proliferations, but I know I get so much more out of it when I'm guided. And some of you, someone was asking about the study groups, which is, I think, a fabulous opportunity to really see investigation in action. Because even though we're reading a book, a text, what we're really doing is talking about our own experience with the ideas and with our own practice as we're reading that text. And then Peter is a master at helping us pose the questions or come at our experience from a slightly different angle that we probably couldn't get at on our very own. That is treasured. I mean, that is treasured by me. And if you have a group that you can do that with, you know, all the better, but or an individual teacher, or as I said, a spiritual seeker, a spiritual friend that you have. So permit me to read one more persuasive statement about investigation. And this statement comes from the book that we're using in the study group, this session, this round. It's by Rodney Smith, and it's called Stepping Out of Self-Deception, The Buddha's Liberating Teachings on No Self. This is the third reading that I've done of this book, and I can't even begin to recommend this book highly enough to you. It is profound, not just page by page, but line by line. It's really something else. And I'm getting, every time I go through it, I get different information, and I feel a somewhat deeper understanding. This is in the section where he's talking about, wise samadhi. He says, or samadhi. Samadhi is experienced as oneness or wholeness of mind, and is therefore the culmination of wise view. Steadiness of mind is essential within the Buddha's path, and sustained attention allows the mind to be present, to understand its nature and how it functions. There you go. To understand the nature of the mind and how it functions. Everything, he says, depends upon stability of focus and investigating the nature of our contracted life. Investigating the nature of our contracted life. And only through stable attention can we see the problem and decipher the cause. Discerning the difference between thinking about something and directly experiencing it is the function of samadhi. Through the quiet, abiding attention of samadhi, We see clearly how the self comes into being through commentary we infuse and the narrative we create. So those of you, and I know there are several of you in the meeting tonight who are in the study group with Peter, know this is what we do. This is what he guides us to do. To he's provocative in the questions that he asks and the way he asks us to think about what is happening to us when we're meditating or as we're considering the maneuvers of the mind. So that sort of brings us up to date. That was a long kind of wind up there, but that kind of brings us up to date to where we've been or where I've been in this conversation that started on the very first day of my retreat in July and is ongoing as we speak tonight in my consideration of the hindrances and my own study and practice and experience with a group of investigating what's going on in our minds. So this week, I want to go over yet another protocol for investigation. And this is by Shyla Catherine from her book called Beyond Distraction. So she makes a strong recommendation for improving our ability to investigate our practice. So here's the protocol that it's sort of a summary of several chapters in her book where she is really digging deep into the process of investigation. So some of this is going to echo some of the protocols that we saw from Joseph Goldstein and from Gil Fronsdale. The first one, which is also the very first one of Goldstein's and Fronsdale, is to observe. And so we know this from our work with Peter. We know this from our training in meditation. We have to learn how to observe our own mind, even as we're trying to quiet our own mind, which is kind of a tricky thing to do. And one of the most powerful bits of advice in this book that Shyla Catherine talks about is the power of the pause. Peter has talked about this quite often too. So she says that many unwanted habitual patterns can be stopped by simply, can be countered, she says, by simply stopping, pausing, and observing. In the moment of pause, you are observing rather than reacting to experience. Noting and naming is one of the primary teachings that I have just learned last week is not actually a teaching of the Buddha, but has in the past centuries of people interpreting him and teaching him has become a common practice in our practice. We note and name. We note anger is here. We note confusion is here. We note rumination, prapancha is here. And that's a really powerful way to get into that pause that she talks about. Peter adds often in his conversations around this topic, Peter will say, get curious about it. Get curious about what's going on in your own practice, in your own mind. And I think that's wise advice. So that's the first step. The first step of the protocol is observe and accept what's going on in your mind. Don't berate yourself. Don't get unhappy with yourself. Don't tell yourself that you're a jerk or that you're a slug or whatever. Just note what is happening. The second step, she calls it investigating your thinking. So what she does in these two or three powerful chapters where she's really diving deep into this notion of investigation is she asks a series of questions. And that's kind of what I've done here in step two and step three is just try to pull together and consolidate because there are many, many questions that she offers for the person who is endeavoring to investigate. But I've just sort of pulled together some that I've used in workshops on the hindrances with my own students and found productive. So one of the first questions that she asks, and that I ask, in fact, I taught a meditation class today to a group of people, a group of women, and this was one of the questions I was asking them to answer was to try to begin to notice what particular or unique or typical kind of proliferation when you get lost in thought. What is the pattern of your lostness? Some of you may know this immediately. You may have done this kind of investigation. The proliferation of the mind, as I said, called prapancha, goes on when we get lost in thought, when we lose the anchor, we lose that attention and focus on the breath. And so for me, planning is a sort of go-to habit pattern that I have when I get lost in thought. I'll be planning something. I might be planning a talk or planning a lesson or planning a dinner that I'm going to serve or planning the route that I'm going to go on when I have to run errands after I meditate. It's ridiculous. Sometimes I'm not very good about being totally accepting of my proliferation. Some people are worriers. Some people, when they become lost in thought, begin berating themselves or telling themselves they can't do this, that this is just not good. Some people are doomsayers. Some people are rehearsing conversations that they had yesterday or last week or 10 years ago with a former lover, or anticipating conversations that they're going to have. I find myself doing that one a lot. Creating dialogues. So noticing the nature of your proliferations, that's a form of observation. We can't then begin to investigate it until we begin to pin it down and begin to try to come up with some kind of understanding of why that is going on or deepen our capacity for letting it go, just letting it go. So she asked the question, is this thought pattern useful to you in some way? And yeah, I've gotten into trouble with asking this question sometimes. In fact, I asked this question of a client of mine last Sunday when she was repeating a story that she has repeated to me easily 50 times. And I'm not exaggerating. She has told this story over the years 50 times to me at least. And I finally asked her, I always try to hold space and be patient with it, but I thought I've got to get out of hearing this story again. And so I asked her, can you tell me if this recounting of this story is useful to you? Is it benefiting you? I'm totally happy to hold space for it, but is it benefiting you in some way? Is it moving you forward in your practice or in your work, in your creative life? We had a good conversation about that, but I also realized that was a question that could have also gone wrong pretty quickly. Another question she asked under this step two of investigation is, is this true in all situations? So, for the person who proliferates in a negative talk about themselves, that's a great question. You say you're dim-witted. Well, are you dim-witted in every situation in your life or just in certain situations in your life? So, just trying to back people down from the exaggerations or, the exaggerations they might be expressing. What are you getting out of this kind of thought? This being when you go into this particular kind of proliferation, what is it serving? Or what is this habitual pattern or addictive urge done for you? And that's a really difficult question, but so provocative and so helpful if you can have a good guide to help you work through trying to analyze, well, how does this, what am I getting out of this? Is it feeding my ego or is it keeping me from moving forward in my practice? And I'm afraid of moving forward in my practice. All kinds of directions that you can go. There's no one way that any of these questions would work out because, of course, we're all individual and very unique. Another great question she offers for this stage of the protocol is this process, this observation that you've made about a hindrance, fulfilling a craving for a sense of pleasure or personal need, or confirming a view, a value, or identity? And some of you may remember from my talk in August about the retreat that one of the biggest hindrances that I faced that week came in the second day when I had this reverie, as I called it, which was kind of an erotic reverie. And I could not let it go. I could not, I had a hard time, but it took me several months to let it go. And I really did work on this question of what craving for sense pleasure or personal need or confirming of a view it is bringing this reverie to me, which is a whole conversation in itself, but we don't need to go into that. The next question she poses under investigation is there another way of seeing this? Is there another way of seeing this? Such a simple question. And yet, so often we don't do that naturally to ourselves. It sort of takes an outside person to pose that question and kind of wake us up or jerk us alive to understanding that, oh yeah, there are probably multiple ways of seeing this. Another question that I like and have found very helpful in groups that I've led through this process is how would you feel if this hindrance was not in your life right now? What would your life be like, or what would your practice be like if you didn't fall asleep every time you were practicing? So, again, this is a question that really gets at the nature of our seeing, our suffering, and its causes. Really important to understand. Sometimes we're suffering and we're not even aware that it's a form of suffering. And beyond that, we're not even aware of what are the causes of that suffering. Okay, here's the one I love the most. She says, what are the dangers, costs, and risks or risks of not dealing with a hindrance that you are aware exists in your practice? What are you paying? What's the price you're paying, both in your practice and in your life, for holding on to this particular kind of proliferation? What positive thought could replace this condition I'm having? What positive thought? So there we get right effort coming into the field of investigation where we're asked to replace, well, first of all, recognize thoughts that are not beneficial and disarm them, or recognize, replace those thoughts with positive thoughts and reinforce them. Right effort. I hate to say this, so Steve, just don't laugh at me, but I'm going to quote the Buddha again with this question when he says, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. So it's really important, if that's true, if the Buddha is true, and I believe he was right, what one frequently thinks and ponders upon thus becomes the inclination of the mind. And if you're thinking or proliferating with negative thoughts, criticisms of yourself, judgments of other people, guess what? That becomes the nature of your mind. Criticism, negative thoughts, not so much fun. So we want to note whether our thoughts are supporting or sabotaging our deepest aspirations. Are they nourishing our personal values and life goals? Are they nourishing our habituation to positive thoughts, positive beliefs? Shauna Catherine says, a brief inquiry into the formations of thought performed by a tranquil mind can penetrate entrenched habit patterns and produce a more accurate and useful perception of experience. Oh, yep, that's what I want. That's exactly what I want. I'm going to read it again. A brief inquiry into the formations of thought performed by a tranquil mind can penetrate entrenched habit patterns and produce a more accurate and useful perception of experience. She's a genius. I mean, she's an absolute genius. I'm sorry, you guys. I know I have a tendency to talk louder and louder when I get really excited. I'm going to tone it down a little bit. Nobody likes to be yelled at. Okay, I'm going to come back to that passage that I just read from Shiloh Catherine in just a minute, but I want to go on first to the third step that she asks us to undertake in this investigative process, and that is to act. Take wise action by eliminating non-beneficial thoughts, establishing brave action, and creating accountability. Now, I love that because I think we all know and practice and, are fully aware as the fairly experienced practitioners that we're trying to eliminate non-beneficial thoughts. We're trying to promote beneficial thoughts. We're wanting to establish brave action as a result of those thoughts. But I don't see very much talk about accountability. Now, I come from the coaching world. After I was an academic, I was a personal coach for about a decade, and accountability was something I spent a lot of time on in working with my clients because I found if I didn't figure out ways to hold them accountable, and I know this about myself, it just won't get done. Certain things just won't get done. How many of you stopped an exercise program midway through January because you didn't have an accountability partner? That's kind of the way the book study groups go too. I feel like when I come to the study groups, I'm working with my accountability partners. I'm sharing my struggles or my insights or questioning with other people who are doing the same thing. It's pretty wonderful. And to quote Shiloh Catherine on this topic, she says, act so that defilements are weakened and wholesome states are strengthened. Whew, good stuff. So act under the category, in this protocol, three-step protocol, the third step is act. And here are some of the questions that she poses. What are some alternative thoughts or reminders that might make a positive shift in this pattern? You might need to write them down and or put them on a 3x5 card and look at alternative thoughts to negative or unbeneficial thoughts that you are ruminating over again and again. Could you starve the habit by working with the desire or the fear that unwholesome thoughts feed on? That's really smart. Let's try to get down underneath those unwholesome thoughts and see what's the fear? What's the desire? What are you yearning for that's not coming about for you? And then consider the possibility of a healthier way of getting your genuine needs met. Now, I want to say just here, I'll come back to this in the Q&A, but I just want to pose this issue that I've been dealing with, and Peter is going to be really helpful to us in this. I can see some of these questions in a not well handled by the facilitator, moving pretty quickly into therapy. And I am certainly not a therapist. So I want to ask Peter, or ask all of you about that. This, how, wh what's the line between investigation and, just getting over into personal narrative or personal therapy of some sort? We'll come back to that. Another question she asks under this category is, does the change you seek require verbal or bodily action, or a shift in the way you think? Now, there's a, a sort of, we talk about an embodied practice. There's a question that really gets at that. Is there something you say, a language that you use, or a pattern in your language that is destructive or not helpful or denigrating in any way? Or is there a bodily action that you could take that would help this? Or do you just need to change the way you think about something? That's a really fascinating question, I think. Do you feel the urgency to improve the quality of your own mind? Oh boy, this gets us back to intention and the teachings that the Buddha has done on intention. And I think it's something, now this is like the last question. No, that's not the last question. The next is the last question. But this should be the first question before you start any kind of investigation, right? Let's get real serious and ask ourselves, do I really want to change my mind? I have a friend who is an alcoholic, and I have been amazed to hear her say, I have no desire to not be an alcoholic. So why do you continue to talk to me about it? She's smarter than I am, I think. Do you feel the urgency to improve the quality of your own mind? And so that might be worth looking at. What is the level of your desire, your urgency to really make changes in the way your mind works, to make deletions in this number of sufferings that you go through on a daily basis? And the final and the best question she poses is, what would it take for you to make these changes? So once you've gone through this questioning process, and I'm not saying, she's not saying that you have to go through all of them in every investigation process, but take a couple of them, and do some writing. I do a lot of it, self-investigation, in my journaling that I do every day after my practice. So those are the three steps then. We have step three is act, step two is investigate your thinking, and step one is observe and accept. So you can see that she's a little bit more in go going, not a little bit, she's going a lot more in depth. I highly recommend Bhante G, and I highly recommend the Gil Fronsdale book. They are both very helpful. And of course, Joseph Goldstein. But this, boy, I'm telling you, this book, Beyond Distraction, is gold. It is a gold mine. So I want to, having posed the questions of the three steps of her protocol, I want to say just a little bit about the value of doing this work in a group. We can't always do this kind of work. Many of us don't have access to a appropriate number of people that we could do this kind of thing with. If you do have a sangha, that's the place to do it. Even better, if you have a study group like Peter offers, that's the place to do it, as well as cultivating some of these questions with your own spiritual friends. So I do think it's good to do this with work, this work with with a group. And I have learned the hard way not to do it with people who are really, oh, how do I say this? Well, I tried doing this with my best friend, and that just didn't work out too well because she was too quick to want to defend me from examining any negativity. She would say, "Oh, no, Leslie, you're so good at that. You're not, so I knew right away, okay, this is not the person to work with because I need somebody that's going to challenge me to help me see something about myself that I can't see my own self. So I really think a good group is helpful. I'm sorry I keep grabbing at my hair, but I've got loose hairs falling down. Okay, so we know that reading, I'm a big reader, most of you are too. And so reading about the Dharma and what constitutes a hindrance is good, of course. So the sutras give directives for extinguishing the hindrances. But Franz Dale and Charlotte Catherine, I think, give us concrete steps for investigation, showing us how to skillfully investigate the issues. But nothing compares really to being in a safe space where you can examine your own specific patterns and see them reflected in the caring responses of other people. It has to be a safe place that you feel comfortable and confident in expressing your hindrances, your vulnerabilities. So once the hindrance is clearly on the table, we investigate the ways to disarm the hindrance. And I want to read, forgive me again, I know it's hard to just listen when you don't have the book, but I do want to read this powerful section from Beyond Distraction by Shiloh Catherine. She says, "The most potent meditative investigation is supported by the stillness of the concentrated mind. The Buddha said, develop concentration. One who is concentrated understands things as they really are. One who is concentrated understands things as they really are." I just read that. An agitated, unfocused mind will not have the steadiness to discern the subtle dynamics of the mind-body processes. It will not be capable of extrapolating the liberating implications from your entrenched perceptions. Entrenched perceptions. Got any of those? Oh boy. During your investigation of causes, conditions, and the qualities of your mind, you will need to maintain a significant degree of mental composure to prevent self-judgment, craving, or identity attachment from hijacking your insights. Meditative investigation is not concerned with personal narratives or the content of proliferating thoughts. The content of proliferating thoughts. So, how do we go about readjusting our thought patterns to be focused always on the content of our thinking and not on the spacious awareness that we know stillness and a contemplative practice brings to us? In my experience of studying the hindrances with other dedicated students of the Dharma has been so instructive for me and so motivating. I'm so grateful when I can have these experiences. We investigate our patterns together. We get more insight, more confidence, more eagerness to move forward in our practice, more urgency about understanding the nature of our mind. And most importantly, I think we get have the experience of listening to somebody else talk about what they think is really screwed up about their own mind and go, "Oh, you have that problem too." So Peter's really good about reminding us that these are patterns that we all have that are repetitive patterns that we share. And it's good to know we're not alone in the struggle that we have with hindrances. So next week, I'm going to do one last session on, not next week, I'm sorry, next month when it's my turn to address you. I'm going to do one last talk on an investigative protocol that many of you know about. I know it's called RAIN. It's an RAIN stands for Recognize, Accept, Investigate, and Non-Identification. So this particular practice, the RAIN practice as it's called, is a protocol that was created about, I don't know, 30 years ago, maybe by a meditation teacher whose name is Michelle McDonald, but it's been made most popular by Tara Brach, and she writes about it in one of her earlier books, Radical Acceptance. So that will be the third and last talk that I will give on investigation, and I hope you will come and share that conversation with me. I asked you last time, and I'm this is one of the bad things about the way we alternate our talks here. I gave you some homework, and that was to really examine your own hindrances. That was last month. So I'm wondering if any of these questions or any of these protocols or any of your own observations about the hindrances that you faced, or the unique hindrance, I should maybe say, maybe you don't have them all. I, as a matter of fact, have all of them in my repertoire, but some of you may just have one serious one. Would you care to share something about what you've learned from trying to examine your hindrance, or ask a question about one of the protocols that I've talked about now? We've got just a few minutes to do that.
For me, there's Satish. For me, it is habitual thinking, problem solving. That's one of the big ones for me.
Well, I'm sorry, I did not hear that.
Habitual problem solving, thinking.
Oh, yeah. Oh, now, is this Will talking?
No,
No.
Satish.
Oh,
Satish.
Satish. Okay. Yeah. Habitual problems. That's Will's too. Habitual, because you probably do a lot of problem solving in your work. Your mind is probably a very skilled problem solving engine. And so why wouldn't that show up in your meditation? But that's good to observe that. Is there a way that you have found that you can disarm that proliferation tendency?
Mostly just be aware of it and
Yep.
stop it.
Yep.
As soon as you're aware, I think it helps. It puts a space between that problem solving and it that helps a lot.
Absolutely, Satish, you're so right. Just being aware of it, Joseph Goldstein says that when just with that one step of observation and awareness, the hindrance itself begins to self-liberate. Just observing it can be, get you 90% of the way. Well, I shouldn't say percentages, but so yeah, good, very good point. And sometimes we forget to do that. Most of the time, we forget to accept it as it is. This is a phenomena that's here. And then we don't just have confidence that being aware of it and making an intention that you're willing to drop it, you're willing to let go of that pattern while you're in meditation is a big step forward too.
It's a matter of replacing the old habit with this new habit of.
Exactly. Right effort, replacing the unwholesome habit with a wholesome habit. Thank you, Satish.
Thank you.
Steve?
Hey, Leslie.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. I'm going to go back to your quote on from Shyla Catherine of that whatever the mind is frequently thinking about, that becomes the inclination. And in what the mind thinks about, I almost consider it to be a new type of a hindrance, as just the digital immersion that, you know, so many of us experience, where, you know, we get reality filtered through all of this opinion. And, you know, just being in the comfort of being in front of that screen, it affects us, and it affects what we even view as being reality. It doesn't come just from experience anymore. Certainly not like in a prior time, when, you know, you might take a flute to the top of a hill and just, you know, experience the world that way. But rather, we don't have to experience anything anymore, because we can conveniently just absorb whatever is there in front of us digitally.
Oh my gosh.
And that becomes what we think about. And in many cases, you know, what do we think about? It's like money, or who we don't like, as if we know who they are. And it becomes charged. So certainly what she says is just pausing it. Or I like to consider the old Get Smart, the original show, where they had, you know, this cone of silence.
Oh yeah.
That could just, you know, you press a button, it just comes down, and you can no longer hear any of the noise at all. Or maybe the other way around, where someone just is so full of noise that you want to press that button and have it go down over them.
Oh, that's so good. I think you should do a Dharma talk on the cone of silence. That's fantastic. Yeah, I think you're so right, talking about the bombardment of, you know, the overstimulation we have. I went to the ballet last week and saw a beautiful performance of Swan Lake, and there was a young woman sitting next to me who filmed the whole performance. She had her camera up on her face filming the show, and I finally leaned over and said, "Honey, why don't you just try watching it and absorbing the energy of the dancers?" No, she didn't want to do that. She wanted to have it on film so she could show her girlfriends, I guess. I don't know. So I get what you're saying. I do want to make one small correction in what you said. That was not Shaila Catherine who said that quotation. That was the Buddha. That's my favorite phrase from the Buddha. And Steve knows how often I use that one a lot, because it's so true. It just is so rich.
Leslie?
It looks like maybe Sharon had a question. Or no, sorry.
Oh.
Peter, was that you?
I do have a
comment.
Oh,
go ahead, Sharon.
I don't know. I mean, I can't see if anybody else is also wanting to speak, but I relate so much to a lot of the things that you say in your self-examination, and your relationship to the teachings and all of that. Many things came up in my mind. One of them had to do with confidence, and having enough ability to deal with things without the doubt. My hindrance, because you led with the hindrance, I have all of them, but the papancha, or I actually worked years ago in a mental health treatment facility, and my supervising person was a psychologist, and she used the term perseverate, which is so close to papancha.
Yep.
You know that word.
Yes, it's a good word.
Yeah, it was a good one. And she would remind me, or she would observe in me. She was a very helpful coworker, because she told me that I tended to perseverate. So anyway,
you nailed you, Sharon.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. I couldn't argue with her. But kind of one of the things when you had spoken about your experience at Goenka, one of the things that caught me and grabbed me, I don't know if I had a chance to mention this, had to do with you commented about not being able to write, not being able to read, the restrictions, and the diet. And this is what I want to say about that, is because we're kind of metabolic creatures. And I find that my abilities to remain equanimous, or to, let's say, not get swept away sometimes when my my metabolism is off, and I may not have the I have to watch what I'm taking into my body and how often and how much I am consuming in terms of my eating, drinking, staying hydrated, which ties into the physicality of the diet. And I remember you said it was a lot of oatmeal and bananas and, you know, things that I was thinking, ugh, you know.
Prunes.
I wouldn't go just for that. Pardon?
Prunes, yeah.
Oh, lots prunes. Well,
yeah,
those are
prunes and bananas and oatmeal. Yeah.
That's standard fare in residential retreat sites.
Yes, it is.
So,
I was just.
Sharon,
yeah,
we don't have how much time left. And I want to put a wrap on this. In terms of the media, respond to Steve's comments, it's an opportunity to practice. One of the things that I do, and I keep up with the news, but I also, you know, we watch things that are entertaining and so forth and so on. I pay attention in a couple of ways. One of them is, what's going on in my body right now? Is my breathing pattern changing? Because I will sit with in my body and my breath in the experience of this show, whatever it is on media. It might be on the computer. So noticing where the tension is and letting it go.
Yes.
Keep an open, literally open mind that's not contracted or trapped or closed. And then also have a sense of what's the intentionality or the hidden message in what's going on in the media. To really have a sense of what the game is. You know, I've talked a lot about we are significantly impacted by growing up in a consumer culture. And consuming is not just about material possessions. It's about ideas, beliefs, identities. And to just use that experience to understand, on the one hand, how I'm experiencing craving and clinging to some extent, and how I'm experiencing letting go of it to some extent, and also what's being enacted, what's being perpetrated in the media in terms of trying to sell me something or trying to make me afraid of something. So I think that's an important thing to understand, that I think it's incumbent on us to understand that what we're exposed to in terms of media is to pay attention to what goes on in the body and the mind. Even if you're looking at a box of cereal, they spent a lot of money designing that box of cereal.
Mm-hmm.
And just to be aware of that. I worked at Disney as a production artist, and I'm very interested in what goes on behind the scenes in any kind of production.
Yeah.
It's all about production in the media these days. So I just want to say that it's an opportunity to practice, but we have to remember, oh, practice here. Notice what's going on and let it go.
Can I add one thing?
And Satish has a comment, and then we need to close it up for the night.
I just wanted to add, like, we have responsibility and not blame it on the media.
Right.
You know, so and we take responsibility how much we are letting ourselves immerse in media.
Right. Exactly. And we can become immersed in not media.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a trap to go the opposite direction. I'm not suggesting that everyone is, you know, mandated to watch the media. But what I'm saying is if you shut it down and build a silo around yourself, that's not helpful either. Everything is an opportunity to practice. We have to bring a mind to bear on that. So thank you very much for your research and your comments, Leslie.
Thank you.
It's our custom, end of our sittings, our meetings, to share a moment of silence together. So let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well and hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy until we have a chance to chat again.